You might be asking, why in the world would anyone preach from the book of Job on Father's Day? Especially this section of Job, where God seems to be triggered a little bit, seems to lose it, kind of like us fathers do sometimes. Like my dad did when I forgot to put the emergency brake on his truck and it rolled down the hill and into the neighbor's watermelon patch. That was just one of many of such times. But it seems like God has kind of lost God's patience here. After 38 chapters of one suffering man and his three well-meaning friends attempting to mansplain the unfathomable, unknowable mysteries of God, God finally has had enough and responds. And God says, who is that darkening counsel with words lacking knowledge? Ouch. I wonder how often God mumbles these words each Sunday as we preachers confidently explain the deep, unknowable mysteries of God with our mansplaining. I am really grateful that Bright did not offer a systematic theology class like so many seminaries require. I feel it's quite arrogant to think we can confine God to a man-made system, a set of boundaries and parameters that God must obey. Seems a little bit arrogant to me. Perhaps a better strategy is to imitate biblical writers like David, who ended a long psalm praising God's wisdom with the words, "Such knowledge is too wonderful for me, too lofty for me to attain." Or Solomon, who wrote, "God has set eternity in the hearts of men, yet they cannot fathom the work God has done." Or Isaiah, who wrote, "God's ways are past knowing, God's understanding beyond searching out." And so as I sat with this text this week, I asked for God's help in preaching from an ancient story about a man suffering devastating, unthinkable loss. Have you ever experienced suffering and loss so deep it brings you to your knees? Well, Job did. In chapter 1, God describes Job as a blameless and upright man who fears God and turns away from evil. Besides being blameless, Job is also incredibly wealthy. He has 7,000 sheep in his fold, 3,000 camels, 500 oxen, 500 donkeys, and many, many servants. He was known at the time as the greatest of all the people of the East. But he would soon find out that no matter how righteous and rich we are, none of us are immune to suffering and loss. It's part of life for all of us. So first, a roving band of thieves invade his property and steal all of his livestock. And then a great storm appears out of nowhere, collapsing his house and killing all 10 of his children at once. In his devastation, Job grows ill, develops painful, oozing, open sores all over his body. He shaves his head, tears his clothes, collapses to the ground, and cries out, "If only my anguish could be weighed and all my misery could be placed on scales, it would surely outweigh all the sand of the seas." Have you ever experienced despair like this? Have you ever wanted to measure and weigh your own suffering? Perhaps your initial response is, "Well, of course not. I mean, yes, I have suffered, but my suffering and my loss do not compare to Job's." This was my initial thought. I thought, how can I relate to Job's suffering? I've never experienced loss quite like this. So I figured perhaps it would be helpful to read the stories of others who have really suffered, who've suffered like Job, to help bring this text into context. So this week I was reading stories of our black sisters and brothers who suffered through the bondage of slavery right here on our soil. Yesterday was Juneteenth, the anniversary of the day federal troops arrived in Galveston, Texas, on June 19, 1865, to announce that all enslaved people were finally free. No longer would they be branded with hot irons, separated from their families, forced to work long hours in the hot sun against their will, and beaten, hanged, or worse if they showed any resistance. I read stories of our current injustices against people of color. Families who today are grieving the loss of fathers taken from them by gunshot or a knee to the neck. When we think of unthinkable suffering like Job's, often our thoughts turn to the tragic suffering endured by our Jewish sisters and brothers in the Holocaust. Suffering like that endured by Viktor Frankl, a child prodigy who was so brilliant as a child, he began taking advanced applied psychology classes in junior high. And as a teenager, he began corresponding with Sigmund Freud and disagreeing with him, challenging, as a youngster, Freud's notion that life is primarily about a search for pleasure. Frankl suggested life instead is a search for meaning. And of course, his theories would be put to the test when he was sent to a Nazi concentration camp shortly after, where he experienced unprecedented horrors and suffering. After he was liberated, Frankl wrote the book Man's Quest for Meaning, where he determined if there is meaning in life, then there must be meaning in suffering, because suffering is an unavoidable part of life. Without suffering and death, human life is not complete. I read about Holocaust survivor Reva Kibbert this week, who remembered the day the German soldiers arrived into her hometown in Warsaw, Poland, and loaded her and her entire family and all of her friends, her teenage friends, onto a train towards a concentration camp. She was 12 years old. Within weeks of her arrival, they would all be gone. She would lose everything dear to her, her entire family, her mother, father, grandparents, cousins, and every one of her teenage friends at age 12. Talk about suffering. I read the story of Elie Wiesel, who founded the Elie Wiesel Foundation for Humanity, dedicated to promoting tolerance and equality for all humans. Because after watching hundreds of fellow humans and friends starved, beaten, and gassed to death, he dedicated his life to the premise that we are all God's children worthy of love and belonging. His time spent in both Ravensbrück and Auschwitz caused him to determine that regardless of our race, faith, culture, sexuality, or any difference, we are all God's children worthy of love and belonging. And so many years later, after a successful career of speaking and writing, in 2008, Wiesel received a phone call from his son to tell him that his investment broker, Bernie Madoff, was arrested for swindling millions of dollars from unsuspecting investors, including Elie Wiesel. Wiesel and his wife, Marion, lost their entire life savings, several million dollars earned through a lifetime of authoring books and speaking. And in addition to his personal wealth, Wiesel's foundation lost $15 million to this crook as well. When Wiesel was asked about his response to his loss, he said, "It's just money. After what I've seen, what is the loss of money in comparison?" And perhaps this is what we would say as well. We would compare our suffering, wouldn't we? Like Job did, like Job longed to do, to measure his suffering, to hold our losses against the suffering of others and possibly minimize it. This is something we humans tend to do, minimize our suffering, something I tend to do all the time. In today's passage, God asked Job, "Who determined the measurements of the earth? Surely you know," God says, with raised eyebrows. Who is able to stretch a measuring tape on God's creation, prescribe boundaries and limits for it? It seems like this is a very human instinct. We think we can judge and measure things that only God has the wisdom to determine, even human loss and suffering. Researcher and author Brené Brown calls this very human phenomenon comparative suffering. Comparative suffering is our instinct to compare levels of suffering, to hold one person's suffering against the suffering of others and measure, comparing the severity. So without thinking, we start to rank our suffering and use it to deny or give ourselves permission to feel. What's my loss? What right do I have to grieve compared to Job, compared to antebellum slaves, compared to Elie Wiesel and Shoah survivors? What right do I have to grieve? I remember last spring when I experienced disappointment because I was looking forward to my hooding ceremony, where my professors and faculty, who spent countless hours training me and my colleagues, would honor us for our accomplishments with a symbolic gesture of passing the guard from one generation of ministers to the next. I'd been looking forward to that ceremony for years, but because of COVID, it was canceled. But instead of acknowledging my loss and grieving that loss, I thought, well, I can't be disappointed about that. I mean, who am I to be sad about missing a stupid ceremony when there are so many people sick and dying from COVID, suffering so much more than me? I got out my little tape measure, measured my suffering against the suffering of others, and I decided, well, I'm just going to stuff it down. I'm just going to hide it away. So where does this instinct, this human instinct, come to do that? Well, Brown suggests it comes from scarcity thinking. We believe that empathy is somehow limited. We think it's like pizza. There's only 8 slices of compassion available, so we better save it for those who are really suffering. If I give myself permission and time to feel these little losses, like the job I lost, the friend who betrayed me or moved away, if I give myself resources of energy and care, if I take the time to sit with God and process them, then I will have less to give the people who really need compassion, those who are really suffering. This is scarcity thinking, and it is not healthy, helpful, or true. Because the truth is, when we practice empathy with ourselves and others, we create more empathy. Empathy is like a muscle that expands when we use it. In fact, the more empathy we show ourselves and others in little things, giving ourselves permission to feel, our capacity to show compassion and empathy for others increases. And I know this because I live with someone who is very, very good at compassion and empathy. And I'm still working on it. And so I often find Sonia taking care of herself when she's sad. I will tend to stuff it down or ignore it and just keep moving on my day. She will sit with God like she did this week. This Thursday was the 6th anniversary of the day her little brother Aaron died of cancer. I was not surprised to find Sonia sitting alone, listening to songs played at his funeral with her journal, writing down her feelings, her thoughts, her griefs, and what God was sharing with her, receiving comfort for her suffering from God, whom Paul called the Father of compassion. Paul wrote, "Blessed be the God and Father of our Lord Jesus Christ, the Father of compassion and the God of all comfort, who comforts us in all our troubles, not just some of them, not if they're big enough or bad enough, but who comforts us in all of our troubles so that we can comfort those who are suffering with the comfort we have received from God." And Sonia is a living example of that. Paul says, "For just as the sufferings of Christ overflow to us, so also through Christ our compassion and comfort overflows to others." We are meant to overflow with compassion and empathy. When we learn to embrace this truth, we are empowered to imitate Christ. Christ was always led by compassion. He grieved constantly in the Gospels. He mourned when Jerusalem rejected him. He wept for the pain Mary and Martha were feeling when their brother Lazarus died. Even though he knew he was about to raise him from the dead, he still grieved over their pain. He showed himself compassion and care in the garden, sweating drips of blood, grieving the pain he would endure on the cross. Jesus knew that in the kingdom there is no scarcity, no reason to avoid grief. There is plenty to go around. In Christ there is no lack of anything. And we carry the Spirit of Christ in our being and the compassion of God that is expansive, unlimited, and overflowing. And so perhaps Father's Day 2021 is an appropriate time to talk about the suffering of Job, because we've had a lot of suffering over the past year. Besides being a day to celebrate and honor our fathers today, many are suffering with feelings of loss today. Loss of fathers, loss of daughters and sons, infertility issues, abandonment, abuse, and of course our long season of COVID-19 ushered in unprecedented suffering and loss in so many new ways. A lot of complicated grief. And so I wonder if you have taken time to grieve your losses, what you've suffered this past year, what you're suffering today. If you've taken time to cast your cares on Christ, who longs to carry them. If you've sat with the Father of compassion and the God of all comfort, who comforts us in all our troubles, every one, no matter how much we try to minimize them. The ancient truth that Job discovered is that there is healing available in the presence of God. Our God is a God of restoration. And when we take the time to grieve and weep over our losses and our sadnesses, weeping endures for a season. But as we process through, joy comes in the morning. After suffering a grave illness, David wrote in Psalm 30, "You have turned my mourning into dancing. You've taken off my sackcloth and clothed me with joy so that my soul may praise you and not be silent. O Lord, my God, I give thanks to you forever." David knew that our God is a God of transformation, restoration. God makes beautiful things out of our dust. And so this morning, perhaps there is some suffering and loss in your life that you have ignored. I know there is for me. Some things that you have pushed away, shoved down, considered not worthy of God's comfort or your own grief. But that's not the way it works. God is here for you this morning. The healer is here. And so as we listen to our final song, I invite you to take a moment to show compassion and care for yourself. For whatever losses you are feeling, whatever suffering has risen to the surface of your heart this morning, that you would allow the Father of compassion and God of all comfort to hold you close this morning.